market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that, like retail sales, has something for everybody. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, the good doctor, Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, mate. How are you?
I am very good.
Are you?
I'm excellent.
Why are you saying, what, excellent?
Yeah.
I think it's a step up from normal. What makes you excellent this morning?
Oh, I feel like I'm $1.4 billion richer, but that's different.
You're buying lunch then?
Yeah, maybe.
I know the answer to this, but for our listeners, why are you $1.4 billion richer?
Oh, it can be a secret. They don't need to know.
You have to share it now. Come
no,
on.
Come on.
You can't drop it
no,
out there.
Shit. It's suspense.
There you go. All right, we'll keep it in suspense. That is the most random tangent in the world. We've actually gone with something we're not going to explain. There you go. Welcome, fools. Thank you for joining us for our weekly podcast. Mate, we got a lot to talk about this week. We've got retail sales. We've got the RBA. We've got Westpac in two separate stories. Google, of course, hits the news. And dear old Crown Casino, mate. It was already being investigated, already questions being asked in an inquiry, and then AUSTRAC. Mate. I don't want to be a Crown director right now. That is a tough one to punch the company's having to go through. All right, mate, without further ado, get straight into it.
Let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, buddy. Retail sales out this week. Let's start with the macro, as we always do. It was one of those something for everyone kind of numbers. So for the month of September, sales were down 1.5% on the preceding month, i.e. August. So that's one in the bear box. In the bull box, it was still up on last September. In other words, retail sales are growing year on year. And the annual rate of retail sales growth, try saying that three times quickly, is still 5.2%. So kind of one of those stories where depending on where you look, things are okay. And of course, Victoria, still the poor man of Australia, the sick man of Australia, if I put it that way. Obviously, they're still struggling down there. We desperately hope you guys are out of lockdown as quickly as possible. But that did drag the national numbers down meaningfully. And again, you can't exclude that because that's real and it's part of the economy. And frankly, it has not only issues for Victoria, but it also has flow-on impacts for the rest of the country. Less demand in Victoria means that, you know, manufacturers and wholesalers and retailers outside Victoria aren't necessarily getting the same business they otherwise would have. What do you make of the retail sales numbers?
I don't pay too much attention to those numbers. I have a high-level take, right? But my high-level take is whether or not the numbers look good or not is almost immaterial.
Okay.
Right? And my high-level take is we're all in deep trouble anyway. So it doesn't matter. The numbers can look whatever they want to look like. Bottom line is all the numbers right now are whatever numbers we see are juiced up. And they're in many ways fake.
Yep.
Right? So they're fake because we don't know what the real unemployment is. We don't know what the real state of the economy is. What we basically know is, there's a lot of stimulus and there's stimulus is doing different things. People are not doing their normal activities. They're doing, different activities, right? So we're in sort of in a new environment, which is hard to tell what these numbers actually mean. In my view, numbers right now tell us nothing overall, right? I mean, it just talks about it talks about short-term sentiment, which is more or less, I think, over the long term, meaningless. So that's my high-level take on it. That's why I actually pay very little attention to those numbers. Plus, I don't invest in retail anyway. So
right.
Yeah. So that's my very high-level take on that.
Nice. I'm going to take a slightly different perspective, maybe the more optimistic perspective. I think you're right about the numbers being fake. Absolutely. I also think though that it is evidence that the stimulus is working. And as much as the stimulus is fake stimulus by definition, the alternative would have been without stimulus, things are much worse. And so to some degree, the money goes into the economy, it gets spent, it provides demand for jobs, all the stuff that stimulus is supposed to do. This is absolutely fake in the sense that it's all stimulus-based spending, but it is by definition working. And I think, if you believe in the stimulus approach, you do it because you want it to do exactly what it's doing. And to hopefully give the economy enough of its own momentum. It's like, I'm thinking back in my head of my dad pushing me along on my bike, no training wheels, but holding the back and kind of running along with me just until I've got enough momentum and skill and confidence to kind of keep going on my own. That's my take on it. So I think to some degree, I actually agree with you in terms of it's exactly completely fake, but that's entirely what stimulus is supposed to do and where it's supposed to be taking us.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I think my issue right now is that I think there are fundamental, really big fundamental issues with the economy, which I think, in my view, the stimulus is actually making it worse.
Okay.
So the stimulus is basically, in many ways, right? It's like you can put a patient on a heart lung machine and keep them alive,
right?
And you can keep them alive for a long time, and you get the sense of, oh, they're alive. Maybe they're going to get out, but actually, they're not going to get out, right? And so it's basically pushing the can. In many ways, I think right now what's happening is there's a bit of pushing the can down the road.
Right.
That's happening. Everyone is trying to. This is not a specific. You know, everyone is trying to do that. Mm-hmm. Right. Whether it is the government or the bank and that's happening globally. I think that that is the bigger problem.
Okay.
I don't know how this is going to manifest itself in. Over the course of time, nothing manifests itself immediately, right? Mm. But how it's going to manifest itself. What is going to be the downside of this? That's not actually clear to me.
Mm.
Yeah. So if that's something that I've been thinking about, is that, you know, there has to be some cost and there has to be some repercussions, right, of kicking the can down the road in many ways, right?
Mm.
So I think what I see right now is a disconnect in terms of, yes, you are pushing, you're creating. So I think stopgap arrangements work well for things that are going to come back. Stopgap arrangements don't work well for things that are not going to come back.
Right.
So it's not really clear to me right now what's coming back, what's not coming back, what's going to recover. Is it just, you know, in many ways, what we know is that if we give people cash, they'll spend it, right? Because their economy works that way.
Mm.
But what's not clear to me is that whether or not there's going to be job creation for the long term. So that's what I think. But, you know, happy to be proven wrong.
I think that's the thing, right? I think that's we're all trying to understand, you know, discern what's going on and where we're going. But we're all at least on the same page of hoping that the future is at least brighter than maybe the present and certainly than it has been in the past. Speaking of that, mate, and speaking of what, you know, maybe you might say, I think this will be making problems worse in that category, or maybe not. The RBA, so the headline is, and I think it's probably right, the RBA has given its clearest sign yet that it'll cut rates. The commentary was really, really, really clear. Based on, look, we will do whatever it takes. We will cut rates. We will put more QE. We will buy more bonds. You know, we want to keep the interest rates down now, the official cash rate and the three-year yield, bond yield. And that's, for those who don't want to get into the nuance of it, I don't blame you, but effectively you want to keep the longer-term lending cost down. So if you're taking a three-year fixed deal, you want that to be as low as possible if you want to try and, particularly for businesses, but also for consumers, if you want to try and, you know, maximize the chance that people will borrow some money. If they know they can borrow it for 3 or 4 or 5 years rather than one and the rate's not variable, in theory it's supposed to aid economic activity. Now, the RBA, now, I say they're given the clearest signal yet, except 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think it was, I think we even talked about it on the podcast, the RBA kind of did the same thing and the markets assumed they built in a rate cut. And then over the kind of preceding or the following 2 weeks, they kind of wound that back, say, oh, no, maybe it won't happen, maybe it won't happen. This time the RBA has gone again with the same kind of language. I think it's clearer this time. I think it's more obvious this time the way they're talking about it. They were very clear about what they might do and what they might have to do. The fact they would do whatever it takes, the fact that rates are staying low for 3 years. If this is not a sign they're going to, I think we can probably give up on trying to read anything into the RBA commentary. Do you have a thought about that?
Yeah. Again, in a similar vein, my thought is, well, I've said this before. I think, you know, the Reserve Bank governor, I would have fired him a long time back.
Okay.
I think he has done a poor job.
Right.
You know, so at this point, I think here's the deal.
Mm.
Okay. My deal is very simple. Cutting the rates help, except the question is, what does it help?
Yeah.
Right. Now, if you cut the rates and you enable borrowing by businesses, innovative businesses creating the 21st century jobs, yes, it helps.
Mm.
Right. It is not immediately obvious, but it does help.
Mm.
So, but if the rate cutting only fuels a property pyramid or fuels more borrowing that is actually going to be spent unwisely, it actually does not help.
Yeah.
So I think long-term competitiveness is what is going to be compromised.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I think about it. I think if you're going to create asset price inflation, then actually you're just breaking, basically digging a hole and then digging a bigger hole and then digging an even bigger hole, and then eventually you're just going to be buried in the hole. That's what's going to happen. So I think that's my issue right now, is that I think all of these strategies are just basically causing asset price inflation. And it's good, you know, okay, share prices are going up, that's fantastic. And but I think I'm not a huge fan of, let me put it this way. I think RBA has very little choice of what it can do. So it clearly is not going to make decisions about
about fiscal policy, industry support, welfare payments. Right.
It's not making those decisions. So it's handicapped. So I understand that. But I think my issue right now is that it is handicapped, but it's only going to make this is an example would be that if you cut take Australian property, right? It's very expensive. It's one of the most expensive in the world, right? It's basically unaffordable. Now, if you only increase the unaffordability further, who does it help?
It only
prices out a bunch of other people who would otherwise get priced, you know, who could afford to buy things, but you're basically pricing them out. And you're not creating any other, you know, new types of jobs, right? So you're basically creating the same types of jobs. I'm trying to hope that, you know, the same engine basically keeps spinning.
Right.
So I don't know where this is headed. I don't have answers, but, you know, those are sort of the questions that I would think what's happening.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's I actually agree with you. I'm really torn on the RBA stuff, because I think independent central banks are important. I think they are arguably necessary. I wouldn't be absolutely, you know, declare that unquestionably. But when you've got a situation where the RBA and the government seem to still not be pulling in the same direction in the same way, or at least with some sort of coordinated action, it makes it really hard, right? Like I can absolutely see the case for, if you trusted, and this is probably the problem, if you trusted politicians enough and you believed that monetary policy, i.e. interest rates, was a core and should be a coordinated part of overall policy setting, i.e. fiscal policy, that is tax and spend, and monetary policy, which is interest rates, are effectively two sides of the same coin, or at least should be pushing in the same strategic direction, it makes sense for those to be controlled by one group of people, or at least in some sort of coordinated fashion. And it really does seem, I mean, I can't complain about the stimulus, so the government's around the kitchen sink at this one. But it's clearly not enough. I mean, the central banks here and around the world are saying, thanks, guys, but that's not enough. I've got to do more. So I've got a couple of thoughts. The first is, I'll just read a bit from Matthew Cranston in the AFR, because this is kind of the summary, right? Economists believe that the RBA will take the form, the rate cut will take the form of a multifaceted rate cut, including the official cash rate to 0.1% and a declaration of intent about outright quantitative easing via large-scale bond purchases. I mean, you can't be clear on that. Now, it may not happen, of course, as I said. There's still a chance that despite the RBA's very, very clear, you know, messaging here, they won't go. And to some degree, they didn't go last month. So you kind of wonder what's changed. I don't know that much has changed. They worry about the exchange rate, apparently. They worry about inflation. They worry about full employment. So it feels to me like, again, I know I've probably said this before. I'm sure I've said this before. But the RBA, with their one lever, maybe two if you include QE, in other words, buying bonds, but they've got one or two levers. You know, they're flying the biplane, the Wright brothers biplane in 1915 or something. The federal government flying either a jumbo or a fighter jet, whichever kind of analogy you prefer, with all the buttons, dials, you know, switches, options available to them. And the RBA, it's kind of like, you know, I agree with you. I absolutely worry about, I'm not super worried about the level of house prices. Well, I'd rather them be lower, but I'm not as worried as you are. But I think the future question you rightly pose is, I completely agree with you, that without additional restrictions on irresponsible borrowing, you do wonder what this actually helps, or at least we know what it helps, but we worry about the implications, right? The multi-decade implications of how much you're borrowing now to buy a house if house prices go up. You've got to try and make that work. And I think if you're going to cut rates like this, to stimulate business activity in particular, which this seems to be about, fair enough, but you've got to find a way to do it in concert with other regulatory bodies, other policies, to make sure you don't absolutely, as you say, create those perverse outcomes.
Yeah, like, you know, so house price, okay, so house price actually by itself does not matter. By itself, the housing price could be whatever. I think it's just an example of bankruptcy of thought process, right? So I think the bankruptcy of thought process is very simple. In my mind, what is it that you a you know, an industry, somebody who wants to borrow, somebody who wants to start a business, somebody who wants to build a factory that they can't build today that they're going to build that's when the rate is 0.01. So the answer to that is it's bankruptcy of ideas.
Right, right.
There is a total bankruptcy of ideas because everybody thinks they can make money off these other things, right? And I think that's where the problem is. There is basically zero innovation happening because, well, you make money this other way, right? And I think this is where the problem is. The problem is that, you know, we've become a society of the pyramid builders or the house builders and this and that instead of being innovative because that's just too hard, right? And I think that, so systematically what we are doing is we are enabling. It's basically like, you know, if you're on a sugar high, the solution to that is to not have more sugar, right? So basically, right. Australia that's overall right. is yep, on yep, a yep. on a sugar high, and we're just giving it more sugar. This is just going to add badly, right? So you know, that's just in my take. I think, you know, that it's again, like, I don't know what problem RBA is solving. As I said, like, you know, I don't know which business. So it could. So here's the thing, right? It could be that the RBA thinks that, well, the banks are not lending or lenders are not lending to people who want to start a business.
That's right.
But that's a policy problem.
Yeah, agreed.
Because today's rates are so low, if you wanted to start a business, you can't start it. Then there's a problem in the way the laws are structured, maybe the bankruptcy laws, maybe the way the approvals are made, maybe the way people evaluate businesses, right? Mm. That's where the problem is.
Yep.
It's not the rate.
Yeah, the difference between borrowing at 4% and 1% is massive.
Yes.
The difference between borrowing at 0.25 and 0.1 is, I'll be a little bit flippant, but it's not miles away from just simply a rounding error. If you can't, if you can't find a project that you can afford to borrow, let's call it $1 million, make my life easy. If you can't borrow $1 million at 0.25, but you will borrow it at 0.1, or that somehow changes your spending or investment behavior, I don't know. Like, I don't, you and I have different visions. I don't blame the RBA because they're in the biplane and they've got to do something. So they're trying to do something because they see that if they don't do something, even marginal, it'll have implications down the road, right? So I'm less critical than you. But I think the broad idea that it's going to have even more than a tiny, tiny marginal impact at that point. At least with otherwise, if you've got to buy bonds and buy bonds, if you've got to make borrowing easier, but changing just the rate without governments and regulators working together to fix the underlying problems that you've identified is exactly the problem.
Well, if I'm the RBA governor and I take $1 million of salary, I would absolutely play poker with the government and say, I'm not moving. You know what? I'm going to move the rates up. I want to see what you're going to do. Fire me. Like, I mean, come on.
I think they would.
And that would be fine. That would be a statement. And then I can go and give a statement on the newspaper saying, well, you know, hey, it does not make sense to cut rates. So, I'll give an example. I made an investment to a project where something is being built, right?
Yep.
And the bank, because of COVID, decided they can't loan.
Right.
You know, so this is an example of where it's not an issue about rates anymore, right? It's an issue about the culture of lending and the, you know, the how you evaluate businesses. And, you know, again, the bank might have, you know, made the right decision. But I think this is an example. This is illustrative of what the bank thinks is okay. The bank would lend $2 million for a property mortgage because that is deemed to be okay.
Right.
But that doesn't create jobs, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's the issue. I think my fundamental issue is we are addressing problems. We are addressing the sugar addiction with sugar, with more sugar.
How do you stop a hangover? You just keep drinking,
right?
Yeah,
well, just, you know, if you're drunk, just keep drinking. Just keep drinking until you pass out. So that's what's happening right now. So I'm a bit saddened by the approach and the style and the lack of awareness. I think that you know, you really need to pick up and do other things. Otherwise, like, there's going to be a time when nobody's going to be interested in mining. What do we do then?
I agree. I think it's a big problem. I think I said, you and I have slightly different perspectives, but the problems and the potential solutions that we're reasonably clear on, that and rates, lower rates. If the low rates are the answer because the rest of policy is so ineffective, then that's the problem. And if low rates aren't the answer, then again, we've got the same problem. It seems like, you know, I've got to say, it frustrates the hell out of me. I mean, you and I do it, right? We talk about the RBA all the time. The financial media, and it's a grab bag term, and it's not everybody, but when we write columns and columns and columns and inches and inches and inches on the RBA, and no one's actually, you know, as if the RBA is the only thing that matters to economic policy and recovery, and we give a relative, you know, carte blanche to the rest of policy. You know, we're looking at the 1% here and ignoring the 99% of stuff that happens elsewhere and saying, let's talk about the RBA and what they should do on rates again. It happens on Twitter. And again, from really smart, sensible people, I actually quite like this slavish kind of, it's almost Pavlovian response to hey, what are the RBA doing? What are they doing? What's this going to matter? And it's like, yeah, okay, that's the right question, I suppose, but only in context. 1% of the question should be, what's the RBA doing? The other 99% has got to be, hey, have we got a bigger problem here? Think about down the track. Let's say this works, but in 3 years' time, rates are still zero, and we have another economic impact. You can't keep cutting rates, and then you make them negative, and then further negative, and more negative, and more negative, and you buy more bonds and more bonds and more bonds. And effectively, this has to lead, if we don't get it back on track, to de facto nationalization of the economy. Like, there is no other alternative. If this is the only path we can go on and can't get back to some sort of normalcy, it goes in one direction. There's no firepower left already. What happens next time? We asked that after the GFC, and the answer was, let's go to zero and let's do QE. Fine. Next time, in 2025 or 7 or 34 or whatever it is, unless we get back to some sort of normalcy, I don't know what tools are left for policymakers, certainly monetary policy, to actually respond to it.
Yeah, I don't have any. I mean, it's a relative game, right? I mean, the one effect that can happen is debasement of the currency, right? So the currency could be completely debased.
Which is what they're trying to do, ironically, and that's part of the RBA saying, was, look, other countries have done this so much, we have to keep up to keep our currency from being too high. I mean, it's crazy. It's self mutually assured destruction financially.
Yeah. So it's debasement of the currency is, I think, part of the game. Although, again, I think it's a trade-off between, you know, you want to be competitive with your exports, right? But I want to be careful, if your exports are raw material, you don't really have a competitive advantage over the long term.
Right, right.
You actually have a deteriorating competitive advantage over the long term.
The best you've got is you can get it out cheaper than somebody else.
Yeah.
But the deeper the hole gets, the worse that problem becomes.
Yeah, worse it is. So I think, it seems like there are some long-term issues here that are just building that are not being addressed. Mm-hmm. But it's not really the RBA's fault. You know, part of this is, I think, these are policy questions that require, decade-long leadership thinking, right? And if we elect people for 3 years where they're just going to do policy for 1 year and then 2 years planning to get re-elected, it's really hard to... So we are kind of out of luck there. So
yeah, I know what you do. I got last comment quickly. I think the problem is, to some degree too, this is an international issue that we're not even close to resolving economically. You know, yes, we can be slightly better or slightly worse than our competitors. And frankly, at a policy level, at a national level, it's the government's job to kind of make us slightly better than everybody else so we can be slightly better off. That's what national governments do and have always done. That's what's behind the US-China trade wars, is both countries trying to make themselves a little bit better at the expense of the other one. That's how these things happen. The broad question of, it's not, if it's just the RBA with this policy problem or the Chinese government with this policy problem, there might be some better options. But man, like, around the world, interest rates are zero. Around the world, GDP growth is hard to come by. Around the world, QE is out of control. The RBA can't, and the government can't resolve it for and by themselves, because getting us out of this hole and back to some sort of normalcy is an international issue. Even if we were the best in the world, that would be slightly better than the rest. But if the world doesn't sort this out, whatever, we know full well we're globally exposed, whatever implications are going to hit us at the same time.
Yeah, like my last comment about that one is, I think there are two different issues here. So one is sort of, more even distribution of wealth, right? That is a different problem. I think that this does not address. However, I do think that what's happening right now is low rates are actually making competitive, innovative and competitive countries further more innovative and competitive, because there are these companies that can do things that they would otherwise find it harder to do.
Right.
So the gap is widening, and the US-China trade war is not about trade, but it's all about basically competitive edge.
Okay.
Who's going to edge out whom in terms of, it's really all about competitive edge, it's having edge on silicon, having edge on, AI, having edge on other things, right?
Yeah.
So I think, in many ways, actually, the lower the rate, it is actually helping certain countries, certain economies over others, and it's just making the gap wider. And that's different, from economic distribution of wealth.
Yeah, agreed. Let's move on to better things. I'm not sure we can. Let's see how we go.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's go to Westpac. Poor old Westpac. Speaking of ructions, changes, new worlds, trying to deal with what's going on, Westpac is probably doing what we all assume might happen, but yet it's something of a notable and probably, I don't want to overplay this, but it may well be the first domino. This is not about lending, this is not about banks, it's not even about branches. This is about the corporate responses effectively to COVID and what the future might look like, both for the companies themselves, for us as employees, and for the broader economy. Westpac is actually choosing to downsize its new office in Barangaroo, which for those in Sydney and those out of Sydney, is the harbourside development that Crown Casinos, we'll talk about them in a minute, we're going to be the kind of key anchor tenant, the six-star casino at the top of that. Barangaroo was this new kind of urban development, lots of, prime real estate, the best businesses wanted to be seen there and get their naming rights on the buildings, all that kind of good stuff. And yet Westpac has made the decision to effectively say, you know what, we are going to be smaller as a head office, excuse me, than we would have been pre-COVID. And I think that's meaningful. You were the one who said, I want to chat about this because it has impacts for everybody. It's got impacts for employees and for Westpac, as I said. The bigger impact though, probably at least the more direct and maybe, proportional impact, the largest one may well be on those property trusts, the REITs, the real estate investment trusts that own these office buildings.
Yeah, I thought this news is really interesting because I would not expect Westpac to be the one sort of making the move, or maybe others are making the move, right. And Westpac is in the news because it's a big one, right?
Yeah.
But it is really symptomatic of if this trend is long-term, right? Mm. If this trend is long-term, it basically means that you're going to have much smaller city centers,
right?
That in turn means that you have all these big office buildings that are now worth them much significantly less because you can't fill them up.
Yep.
But it has flow-on effects. We've got basically a train system, for example, in Sydney that is bringing people into the city.
Right.
Well, you don't need to bring so many people into the city anymore.
Right.
Right. And therefore, by definition, the cafes, the things that open for lunch. And people then have the choice of actually living further away.
And this has been huge, right? Because when there has been the recovery that we've had, again, maybe fake recovery, maybe not, but in any case, the recovery that we've had has largely been suburban. If you go through the city or even talk to cafe owners regularly, I do a Sunday morning spot and I drive into Martin Place in the middle of the Sydney and I speak to the cafe owners around there when I grab a coffee before I'm on, and they have to a person thus far said, well, look, it's getting a little bit better, maybe a bit earlier in the week because some people are working a bit part-time or a few days a week in the office, and that's Monday to Wednesday is kind of improving, but Thursday, Friday is still terrible. The weekends are still terrible. It does seem like a suburban and maybe an online recovery, but the CBDs feel like the areas that are really dragging their feet.
Yeah, I think that's right, and more and more companies, you hear, like global companies that are making these decisions that, okay, you can work forever from home. You don't have to come in. You can work from anywhere you want, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think that that's in an interesting way, it's good, and in an interesting way, it's bad, right?
Yeah.
It's good because it makes hiring talent easy, right? It means a business can be formed anywhere. It doesn't have to be in the city center, right? Somebody could, start one in Mittagong, right? Mm-hmm. If they wanted to, and it could equally be successful because the expectation that you have an office in the center of the city is no longer there, right?
This
is a big deal in that sense. But it does have those, if we have spent so much energy, effort, time, building, and this is not just about Australia, this is worldwide.
Yeah, totally.
Big cities, which are the attraction points, like, think about New York, the people come to see because they're, there's big city centers, right?
And this is fascinating, mate, because I've been reading and listening to different podcasts for years, and one of the kind of Freakonomics, which is a great podcast, I was looking for another one, they interviewed a bloke ages ago talking about the value of cities, and the idea, he makes the claim, and it's probably a little bit outlandish, but stay with us. He makes the claim that cities are more responsible than almost anything else in human history for the progress that we've made because of the way they bring people and ideas and money and whatever else together. And the kind of the, if you look at the wage growth in the CBDs versus the suburbs, for example, or the regional towns and cities, so the, particularly not so much in Australia, we don't have that many, we're pretty coastal, nothing's really in between, but you know, the so-called flyover states in the US, for example, where wages and prices haven't kept up because talent has migrated to those places. I think this is the real challenge for us as an economy. On one hand, the Zooms of the world and the Skypes and the whatever else, the Microsoft Teams and whatever else we're using and phone calls, and just the reality that, by the way, bosses can actually let go a little bit of their employees. So they used to kind of, you know, watch Black Hawks. You know, these things can let us do our jobs. And they absolutely do give us more connectivity than if we only had a phone to call. You know, if you and I had to do this over a phone call, we never saw each other, we never used Zoom, that maybe it'd be a different relationship that you and I have, for example. But there's also less incidental exposure. And I think that's where the question is going to be, I think, resolved over the next few years is, you know, yes, we can do our current jobs from home, but what does it mean for innovation? What does it mean for interaction? You know, the guy I might have coffee with, or the casual introduction, or the chat over the literal water cooler. We have a virtual water cooler channel where we kind of, you know, occasionally share ideas and talk rubbish. But I'm absolutely sure that we have less casual interaction as a business being remote than we were in a group. And maybe, is that true for cities itself? Are you hopeful that we can replicate and maybe even, you know, surpass that? Or is this also kind of part silver lining, but genuinely part cloud?
Yeah, I really don't know. Like, I mean, those are really good points. One of the beauties of certain places happens to be the culture of that place, right? You know, so Berlin, for example, is known as like the valley of Europe, right?
Okay.
Right?
Silicon Valley, you mean?
Yeah, Silicon Valley of Europe. Yeah. But if Berlin is Silicon Valley of Europe, yeah, there is a reason why Berlin is that, right? And whatever is that reason?
Yeah.
I mean, if you take people and you make them remote, how does that work?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I mean, you know, so it, in one hand, it does mean opportunity, right? As I said, you know, you can have this happening now in, it doesn't have to be city center. It can happen in Mittagong, out in the south.
Great part of the world, by the way.
Yeah. But
sun's been out today.
No, but what does it mean? I really don't know. So, I mean, there's a plus and a minus to this, like almost like everything. So.
I heard someone say that working remotely is great for getting projects done, but it's tough for starting new projects. And that seems about right to me. Mm. The idea of kind of the brainstorm, the sit around a room, the back and forth, let's catch up again after lunch, or let's go and have lunch and talk about something. Mm. I'm a big fan of remote. We've worked remote since we started the Motley Fool here in Australia. So we're now coming close, to 10 years in Australia. Beginning January 1, 2011, our site went live. So we're getting super close. And we've done it perfectly well. By the same token, we're relatively independent workers as individuals and as, you know, structurally, functionally. We do have a small office actually on the Gold Coast where we have our marketing and operations team get together, and that has been useful for them. So I would imagine the future's a bit hybrid. If I was a betting man, I'd say some combination of, you know, work from home is the default, but let's get together every X often or for specific projects or tasks where one day a week, one day a fortnight, three times a month, you might go and see each other, probably in a co-working space or maybe in a big, you know, meeting room type space that a Westpac might have, for example, where there are no permanent seats, there's just places you can go and meet and kind of catch up. If I was a betting man, I think that's what the future might look like. I do worry a little bit about it, as you say, the Berlin example, even the Valley itself. The idea that, can you get the right talent? Can you have the right ideas? Do you have those casual, you know, how many businesses do we know? The co-founders were like, I was going to start this business. I talked to a friend and they introduced me to another friend of theirs who had similar skills or was thinking the same thing. I do worry about the kind of the innovation spark in a remote world.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and maybe we still have offices, just smaller offices, right? I think, you know, maybe that's what it is. Again, this is going to play out over the next...
Yeah, well.
Half a decade, maybe.
Does it change how you... Have you thought... I mean, this is evolving, right? But does it change how you think about investing or companies or innovation? Or as an investor, has it started to percolate its way through your process?
Well, like in terms of investing, like, you know, one of the things that I think is important in investing is just being flexible, right? You know, nothing is permanent in investing and flexibility is really key. So businesses that are willing to make changes quickly in response to situations sort of like them. So, you know, and businesses that are slow to make changes, again, I don't like them because that basically means that you can fall behind. So that's sort of the only thing. But, you know, other than that, like, you know, there are some grand announcements people make. Mm. Okay, everybody can work from, like, you know, I think Twitter made an announcement that everybody can work from.
Shopify, I think, did as well. Square, obviously. run by the same bloke as Twitter?
Yeah. So, like, I mean, those sort of things, they sound great. Mm-hmm. And it shows that you're agile, which is, mm-hmm. is a positive take, which is better than not being agile.
Correct. But that's right. If you had to choose.
But yeah, but that's what I sort of draw the distinction. So if I have to choose, I'll choose in the agile mm-hmm. bucket versus the non-agile bucket. Mm-hmm. But then you need to look at other things.
I like that. It's something to keep in mind. I think it's, you know, as you rightly point out, it makes technology and innovation, disruption, agility, as you say, far, far more important, right? Because the less structurally kind of supported innovation is, the businesses are, the more it requires on the people and what's being done. For me personally, I'll say it makes me think more about the individuals in an organization and really thinking about, you know, backing not sure individual jockeys to use the analogy, but just the sense that absent some of that structure, some of the structural things that keep businesses going and make them successful, almost that kind of momentum / inertia that just keeps them moving forward almost regardless. When you start to strip away some of the things that deliver those built-in advantages, if you are in the Valley, if you are Westpac, if you are, you know, these businesses have their own drawing power for different reasons for different people. You start to strip a little bit of that away and it really does make you think, well, innovation may be faster, it might be different, it might be, frankly, less expected, right? More unexpected, just the people who are actually running the business who can have that impact on a daily, weekly, monthly basis and then who might leave or join somewhere else are far more useful. Mate, let's stay with Westpac actually, but and speaking of innovation, by the way, let's do our regular segment on Buy Now, Pay Later. It seems like every week there's a new bit of news. And this one is, I've got to say, fascinating to me. I imagine you've got a similar perspective or a similar view anyway, maybe a different view, but an interest in this. Westpac has done a deal with Afterpay, or Afterpay's done a deal with Westpac, depending on which way you want to look at it, for Westpac to provide some retail banking services for Afterpay's customers. And specifically, and correct me if I'm wrong, mate, because you're closer than I am, but a savings account for consumers and some cash flow management services / functions. I haven't been super clear on if the company's been super clear on what those are necessarily, but both being powered by Westpac. Now, I really like this because I think I have, you and I mentioned this before, and I don't have a strong view on this, but I think if I was going to highlight Afterpay's biggest risks, it would be that they get disintermediated themselves, that banks or credit card companies start providing those Afterpay-like services and simply remove the need for the middleman, right? If you can use your Visa card, so Zip's done a deal, for example, where you can use your Visa card and it automatically fractionalizes it for you. It's Tap and Zip, I think they're calling it, but that kind of idea of, you know, it just becomes such a fundamental part of every transaction that there's no need for an Afterpay. So I think that's, if I was going to put down a concern or a risk, that'd be near the top of my list. And again, feel free to disabuse me of the notion. But what I like about this deal for Afterpay's perspective is they are maybe responding to that, maybe just doing it anyway and it just happened to coincide. But getting into retail banking deepens the relationship, firstly. So if I'm an Afterpay customer and I pay, I can be an Afterpay customer when I save or when I receive money from my employer or when I transfer money to or from my friends. So that helps. If I'm an Afterpay retailer, they'll help me manage my cash flow. And that sort of seems to make sense as long as the idea is attractive enough. And I have to say a little bit like you talked about Square and PayPal before in this context, I think on the podcast, and so I'm stealing your idea to some degree, assuming you agree that it makes sense here. Afterpay can actually keep potentially more money inside its own ecosystem without ever actually sending it to someone else. If I'm an Afterpay customer and you're an Afterpay business, I can use my Afterpay savings account to pay you as an Afterpay retailer, which goes to your Afterpay cash flow management system. There's a lot more touch points. It gets to keep a lot more of the flow of that cash potentially, even though the deal is with Westpac rather than doing it itself. But it just deepening the relationship and kind of, you know, almost ring fencing some of those transactions both feel like smart ways to build some more of Fortress Afterpay.
Yeah, so I really like this, again, for all those reasons that you mentioned. And I don't know the details yet of what exactly this looks like.
It's a little vague, isn't it, so far?
It's a bit vague.
It's smart, though, I think.
It's very smart. And, you know, again, Afterpay is not really getting a banking license here, right? It's, you know, like maybe this is the first step towards getting a banking license.
That's what I wanted.
Right? Baby step towards getting a banking license, which I think would be fascinating. If Afterpay has to be 5 times the size or 10 times the size of what it is today,
yep.
that would almost seem like a natural progression, right? Getting a banking license, actually becoming a new age bank, that yeah. operates with a very different model than the current banks do,
yeah.
right? But again, you know, full credit to Westpac and Afterpay for sort of, you know, thinking about this and mm-hmm. making a deal. Again, I think it's fascinating. This is sort of similar to what, you know, Square has got a banking yeah. license now. Yeah. So
it's got to, don't they? Like, it, I mean, it's probably in regulatory dramas, and I know that probably puts them closer towards credit code compliance and that kind of stuff. Yeah. But if you think about, actually, Square's got one over there. Even we talked to Superhero last week, and the idea of they've, I mean, even listening to what they've done, frankly, the number of hoops they've had to jump or whatever, but in doing so, they don't become the fly-by-night guys who happen to be cheap. They are literally saying, look, we have done everything we need to do, and this is not an endorsement, by the way, but we've done everything we need to. We've done this guide, this regulatory rule. We've had PwC come and audit our stuff. We've got two-factor authentication over here. Those kind of ideas, they really do, you know, it's hard to do. But once you've done them, it really gives you some credibility and some ability to actually fight back against the others and say, well, we are this. We are, you know, we have this license. It makes more sense for us as a business. We can keep more of the value of the transaction rather than having to palm it off because we've done the work to set that up. Are they playing Westpac as patsies, do you think? Or is there some future deal that makes them part of the same business? Or how does this roll out?
I really don't know. Like, I mean, the one thing that I really think that the Afterpay team, though, is a fascinating team. It's a fascinating yeah. team because they're really, I think the way they're operating, I call it bringing the Valley style approach,
ooh, okay.
the Valley style mentality.
And how would you characterize that in Afterpay's context?
Well, like, I mean, you know, the way they're just, like a lot of these things that they're doing, right? You know, it almost seems like they have a business plan where they've written up, this is what's going to happen, what the 5-year plan is going to look like.
Yeah, right.
And we're just going to execute it step by step. Even simple things like the way they organize their conference calls, it's so nicely done. I mean, the more I look at this company, I'm impressed. I'm impressed
yeah,
by
yeah.
their ability to execute, their ability to connect with customers. These are things that I don't generally expect
right.
when I look at a company, right? But their ability to connect with consumers, like, you know, so the ability to provide a product that your consumers love, that's really hard.
Yeah,
very right. few companies actually crack that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Very few companies crack that. And Afterpay has actually cracked it. They provide a product that their consumers, you know, their users want, right?
Yeah,
for whatever reason,
yeah,
but they do. And then, you know, they sort of are building a small ecosystem around that product, around the core product. This is very, very smart. So I really like their execution. I really like how they've, you know, and also the other thing I really like about this company is that they are they think big.
Yeah, okay.
Right? And if you think small, you're never going to be big,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Yes, thinking big can result in failure,
yeah, right.
but it's much better to fail thinking big than to never think big and
just play.
You know. So it's like if you want to play a World Cup cricket, but if you think that I'm going to play county cricket and that's enough, then you're only going to play county cricket and that's
right.
it, right?
Yes.
So these guys are playing.
You do just enough to get good at county cricket,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So these guys are playing the World Cup and I just, you know, I salute them for trying to play the World Cup and actually being really good at that. So I really like this.
It's, I like that. Yeah, it's the old line. It's a bit trite, a bit cliched, but it's the old, you know, shoot for the moon, at least you'll land among the stars. That idea of if you try, and of course you could crash and burn on the launch pad, right? That's the risk, as you rightly said. But you can't. Or the other one I like is you can't cross a chasm in two short jumps.
Yes,
yeah, you've got to go the whole way,
yeah.
and you may not make it. But you're absolutely not going to make it if you don't try the whole big jump in one go.
If you didn't try, then the answer is that you're not going to make it.
Right,
we
exactly,
know that.
Exactly.
So yeah, and full credit to Afterpay. It's rare, right? How many times have you found an Australian company that's actually created a category that hundreds of other companies want to copy?
Super cool.
Which you are able to then take overseas and expand and expand your market share while even trying to think about, okay, let's become slightly like a bank, right?
Yeah.
I think that is commendable and I commend them when they do that. So again, as I said, I like Afterpay for their execution and what they're doing.
I will never forget, and much to my chagrin, because I still don't own Afterpay shares, their sales deck, their sales pitch deck was really, really, really smart. It was one of those things that seems stupidly simple. Now, the tech behind it's hard, right? So I'm not saying it was easy to do. But to your point about the connection piece, the bit about taking the tech and turning it into a product, they simply said to their retailers, look, you will pay us for this, but here's the case studies of where we've introduced this whole new concept and look at what it's done for the sales of these retailers. Yeah. And it was simply a matter, and I don't know the numbers, it was something like 30-40% more sales on average or something like that because you gave them this payment option. And as a retailer, it was such a stupidly obvious thing. Well, okay, I've got to pay my 5%, but I'm going to get 40% more sales. Why would I not do this? In other words, the friction of accepting it and the upside was so tiny, it made no sense not to do it. And on the flip side, for consumers, again, it's a no-brainer. It's a cost-free way to pay later. I mean, you know, you don't get something for nothing very often in this world. And that was a simple something for nothing solution. So again, I completely concur that the business they built, but the way they sold it, particularly to their retail partners, was just, and again, it's obvious, right? Of course you would say, well, you can make more sales and make you more money, but it actually did. And it was very, very smart of them to do that. And again, it was one of those network effect businesses. The more retailers you have, the more consumers will want to sign up. The more consumers who sign up, the more retailers need it, to the point where you can't not have Afterpay anymore. They've literally locked themselves in by sheer consumer demand they've created. It's a really, really smart growth strategy they pursued, and they're definitely getting the benefit of it now.
Yeah, no, really cool.
At the same time, Westpac sold or is going to sell their stake in Zip. Or ZipPay. ZipCo is the name of the company. ZipPay, the product, largely. A couple of products they've got. The company, Westpac, was very keen to say, no, it's nothing to do with our deal with Afterpay. We're just selling it because it makes sense. We still want to work with Zip. We still want to be integrated with Zip. We still want to do the right thing. We still want to be part of this growth story, you know, BNPL player agnostic. They don't really care who wins. They want to be part of it, make sure they can clip some of the ticket on the way through. Makes some sense. This is a pretty good deal. You don't very often, you know, associate large, established, blue chip, and we'll put in brackets, slow, steady, and boring, and not very interesting Australian companies, with these sort of investments. They invested something like, and I'll fudge the numbers, about $45, $50 million in Zip. They're going to sell a stake worth about $339 million. That's a pretty good return for Telstra's tried to have this VC arm. Westpac's got its own VC arm. Ironically, this deal wasn't actually done as part of that VC arm. Westpac did it directly, so you can make of that what you will. It's not very often a large Australian kind of incumbent gets a slice of a flyer like Zip, and they're cashing out. Do you believe them? Are they cashing out because of the Afterpay deal, or has it just happened to be on the same day and they're just using the opportunity to announce both at the same time?
I'm just going to say congratulations to Westpac for making...
You don't say that very often.
When
Australian bank gets congratulations from you, this is a red letter day.
It's making that, you know, what's a 5-6 bag or whatever they're making, right? That's awesome.
Especially for, again, of all the people who would have made this deal, you wouldn't have picked one of the top four Australian banks.
Well, here's the thing, right? And if they had picked it, I would have thought they would sell it on a double. They have actually held it this long.
Yeah.
I think this is smart. Like, here's the way I justify it is that... especially given that they're VC, you know, first they're not supposed to be in the business of being in VC.
Right,
a bank, mostly a retail bank. I don't expect them to behave like VCs, but okay, you got one right. Mm. You've made a lot of money. You want to get out. It's all good.
Yeah,
I don't read too much into it. I think that, you know, they're going to get some money back.
I like it. It's it makes perfect sense. Mate, let's move on to a slightly controversial topic, only because it involves a couple of tech companies that you and I have different perspectives on, or at least different ownership of. But let's try and do it with a bit of as unbiased as we can put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, this week, the US Department of Justice has opened an antitrust suit. Now, that's a very specific US term. It basically is a abuse of market power suit, let's call it that, against Google, saying that, or at least alleging that Google is misusing the market power it has to advantage itself and disadvantage its competitors. And I think this is the first big one. Is the first big one since Microsoft? Have I missed one in between in the US?
No, I think that's right. The first big one.
So Microsoft was taken through the ringer by both European and the Americans for their Internet Explorer browser when they basically managed to, inadvertently, they would say, and I won't make any allegations here, kill off Netscape Navigator, which for those who've been around for a bit on the internet will remember way back in the day, Internet Explorer became the dominant browser because it was shipped with Windows. And the allegations were that Microsoft was misusing its market power by effectively producing and including a competitor, Netscape, which effectively had the impact of really damaging Netscape's business. I think in the event, that kind of is what tend to happen, although ironically the winner in the browser wars thus far has actually been Chrome from Google rather than Internet Explorer, which maybe tells us something about the pace of innovation and change. I know you have your view on regulators, which I'm sure you'll share in a minute, which might correlate with that. But fast forward now, man, is it 20 years? I think it is. Jeez, I'm getting old. Fast forward 20-odd years, Google is now on the company's side, the Department of Justice's side, I should say, and there are talks that businesses like Apple and Amazon, maybe even Facebook, are next on the DOJ's target list. And this is it's a fascinating time because we haven't seen, I mean, Microsoft was forced to kind of unbundle Internet Explorer. We haven't seen big, though, corporate actions. I mean, that was reasonably minor in the scheme of things, big deal and fought hard by Microsoft and others. But you've got to go back to the kind of 80s to really find cases where businesses were forcibly split by regulators. And the big one in the US was AT&T, their version of Telstra, I suppose, back in the day, that was forcibly split up into smaller components to try and put some competition back into the telecommunications market. Now, that was voice calls way back in the day. We haven't seen much since, but there are rumblings now. There's increasing amounts of noise being made by different political parties, by different legal scholars, by consumer advocates to say Amazon should be broken up, Google should be broken up. I don't think anyone's saying about Apple, but certainly the App Store, the Epic Games, the Fortnite kind of palaver of a couple of months ago now where there was allegations that Apple had excess market power and was abusing that market power. This is an interesting time to be a tech company and potentially a tech investor. We've gone, you know, 20 years from 2000 when dot-com was kind of, you know, the dot-com boom and then crash. We're now at a point where I won't tell you the end game because as I've just mentioned about Microsoft, you know, the browser wars weren't the end game at all, at least not at that point in the story. But we are kind of at a point where it feels like these businesses are all maturing or are matured or starting to mature around the same time. And regulators are starting to look at that and go, are these guys the new Walmart? Are they the new AT&T? Are they the new, you know, too big to be allowed to succeed in the current market environment?
Oh, wait. how long do you want this to be? okay. So let's start with the Google one, right? So first of all, I think I don't love Google. But I'm, you know, and I'm not a fan of Google's. So the word I'm not a fan of is not that Google has market dominance, mm-hmm. right? That is not a problem in my view. I'm not a fan of Google's approach to data,
right?
And data store, okay. and being the arbiter of data. So that's what I'm not a fan of.
Is this and that sounds different to me? Just be clear than the actual. So there's not a lot of data and privacy isn't the core of this particular.
Exactly, that's not the core. Right, so they're not addressing. They're addressing a different problem now. Okay. Let's first talk about this one, and then we can circle back to the Microsoft one.
Okay.
So, if you read actually the filings, any sensible person reading the finals will actually start laughing.
Right.
Okay. So let me give you an example, and this is not the exact words, but
that's not libel anybody, by the way.
Yeah, I'm not libeling anyone, but I'm just going to have some laugh here. So Google is very dominant in search.
Yes.
It is extremely dominant. It is keeping competition, putting competition. You know, it's not allowing competition. But how do we prove that? Oh, it just gave Apple $8 or $10 billion a year.
Right.
How's that market dominance? This is completely opposite. Actually, you could flip the sentence and say, Apple has market dominance, and that's why Apple is demanding $10 billion from Google per year so that it can be a default search engine.
Right.
So it's pretty bizarre, right? Mm-hmm. So who's dominant here? Is it Apple? Is it Google? I don't know. Like, I mean, it's not at all clear to me, right? So in fact, the fact that they're paying for traffic acquisition, does it show dominance? Yes. So they're the number one search engine.
Yeah.
And Apple doesn't love Google.
Yeah.
Right? It could have said that we would make Bing our default search engine.
Right.
Why didn't it do it? So is it because of money or is it because that they know that Google is a better search engine and we still allow people the freedom of choice to use another search engine if they want.
Right.
But we would not compromise our system. Yeah, and somebody wants to pay us money for being the default search engine. Why won't we make some money off it, right? So I don't know how these things are going to stack up in the court, but it really seems difficult to make the argument that, hey, this is the company that has 75% market share, still has to go and pay someone to acquire their traffic.
Yeah.
And it's not clear to me why.
Which is both a combination of A, is it dominance, but also B, and maybe you're making this point or maybe you're not, maybe I'm extracting it from what you're saying, but it's also to some degree the idea that the source of that dominance, i.e. web traffic, is changing because Google needs to be on the app because the app isn't the web. If I jump on my browser and I type in google.com to search for something, that's one thing. If I'm using an app which has preloaded or a phone which has preloaded search default software, that's a whole different platform in and of itself, right? That almost, you know, the changes there, a bit like Internet Explorer and Netscape Navigator, you know, the DOJ were solving the 1990s problem. Fast forward 20 years and neither of those two players ends up winning in this story.
Yeah, so like, I mean, I what I'm saying is that they are dominant,
yeah.
but the way you're trying to prove dominance,
yes, that's right.
is not useful in my view, because I mean, you know, dominant players don't, you know, dominant players crush other people and say, well, you know, I wouldn't allow you, I wouldn't pay you to be a default or whatever they are actually paying, right? So so there's that. Now, I think the flow-on effects of that are undeniable, right? So the flow-on effect is if you're dominant in search, then you can control how your search algorithms work, and that in turn has impact on other things. I think what often regulators miss, because I think regulators by default are not that imaginative, is that the innovation typically does not come from what innovation of something new does not really come from those platforms that exist, right?
Yeah.
So it's quite likely that the search in its current form is going to get disrupted by something completely different from search, right? So in other words, enabling competition in search is really should not be the answer. I think the answer should be to enable competition overall to enable innovation.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily mean this exactly like they were tackling the wrong problem when it came to the Windows environment, right?
Yeah,
did it really matter whether it was Netflix or Mozilla or whatever else, or Netscape or Mozilla or whatever else versus Internet Explorer? It did not, right? Because at that time, people thought that the browser was the...
Right, yes, this is pre-smartphone, pre-whatever else, right?
No, but I mean, the very thought that the browser was the platform through which you're going to make money.
Okay.
Why would you think that?
Yeah.
Because the browser is a door...
Yeah.
That opens you to this world, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That world is where the opportunity was, right?
Particularly when you weren't ever paying for the browsers themselves anyway. There was no sense that there's never been a commercial case for... I mean, maybe if you're the default search provider on the browser, there's like a second order impact. Maybe in some future world, Bing is massive because everyone uses Internet Explorer, but people aren't that silly.
Yeah, like, and I think like you can make arguments about all these things. You know, so you could make an argument that app stores are dominant, right? But has that stopped innovation?
Yeah.
So my threshold really is to ask whether or not there is innovation or not, right? The App Store has enabled the Ubers, the Lyfts, the Airbnbs, and so on, right? Now, whether or not they want a part of that transaction and a cost of that transaction flow, that's a matter between those people, and they can sort it out, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, in many ways, the platform enables something, and if that something is not available, then people will get pissed off. And if they get pissed off, then they will, you know, create noise, right? It's so I don't know what the salts... and in my view, I think it does not address the real issues, right? You know, I think you want to control market power, but this almost seems to be going about the wrong way. But anyways, this is probably going to.
I largely agree with you. I think there is some if we had two Australian banks making super normal profits, I think you and I would probably say there needs to be more competition in the banking space. We need to work out a way that banks can't take too much money off the table. And I'm a Google shareholder, you're an Apple shareholder, so I have as much, maybe less to lose than you do. Maybe Apple makes more money from the App Store, but broadly speaking, I do wonder whether the App Store is so closely tied to the operating system, so closely tied to the phones, again, not Apple, not Google, but both, and as a Google shareholder, I'm absolutely saying this as hopefully an independent kind of observer, but I do wonder whether two dominant App Stores that get to charge a percentage of revenue that seems higher than would be the case elsewhere. Again, are they creating the value? Absolutely. Banks could say, well, without us, you can't, transact. And so we're providing a service. You've got to pay us all 30% of your transaction, revenue that goes through the banks to make money. We'd all be like, nah, you know what? That doesn't seem like it's a reasonable way to go. It's probably a bad analogy. But I think there is some sense that it's worth asking the question of, is a 30% clip sufficiently competitive compared to either what it might be or with a third OS or the retail world or the physical world or something else, just to kind of work out, I mean, that's the AT&T question, right? That is how much value do you allow one company to capture, and at what point does that suggest a lack of competition versus, as you say, enabling of a whole ecosystem? And I think you're right, by the way. I'm not disagreeing with your point that it absolutely allows the Uber. I mean, Uber doesn't exist without the app stores, right? It's not a zero. But I do wonder how we think about not should we regulate, shouldn't we? Should we break it up, shouldn't we? They're probably the end point questions or the end point answers. Sorry, the question to me is how do we think cleverly about how much value is created and how much of that value should go to a two horse race, you know, with not a lot of super overlapping competition, as opposed to trying to find the right price or the right, you know, ticket size, the right amount of revenue that a dominant gatekeeper should be allowed to collect on the way through.
Yeah, so like, you know, I'm pretty ambivalent on that, largely because I think what's so here's the thing, right? If you want to have good global services, you will not have multiple players. There can't be multiple players, right? Expecting multiple players, basically, nobody's going to develop, no developer is going to develop apps for multiple platforms.
Right.
It just doesn't work.
Well, maybe multiple, but not like, yeah, maybe two or three, but not 10 or 15, right?
Well, it's not going to... You know, even two people don't do it today, right? I mean, you know, people who are going to develop first for the app, the Apple's App Store, and then if they feel like they're going to develop for, you know, it's economics that dictates, right?
Totally.
And hey, you can design a free app and monetize your audience or whatever you're doing in a different way, and nobody's going to charge you anything, right? So, and then this idea that Apple makes a ton of money, or you know, Google, actually Apple does not make a ton of money from the App Store. So, I think those are fringe. Those are like fringe discussions, in my view, that just don't matter. Because, I mean, I think the flip side that we don't realize is we can go back the alternative could be a world full of malware or a world full of disruptive apps that are taking control of your phones, that are stealing your data, right? Who's going to ensure that, right? So you need somebody to be, you know, the guardian for doing that. And I think you want actually concentration here. You know, two is probably, maybe three at most is what you can... For people to, you know, developers don't have free time to develop X number of apps for, you know, X type of different environments and then keep up and then make sure that it is maintained. So, I don't have a problem with the distribution model as such. And I think it's not harming people in any way, right? Yeah. And I think the issue might be that, here's another way to think about it. I think most of the time the complaints come. So here, I'll give an example. Spotify would come and say, oh, I can't do this X, Y, and Z. To that, my answer is, if you're selling a commodity solution called music streaming, which is basically buying somebody else's music and then putting it on the pipe, you are a marginal business to start off. Go start something else. Right? I mean, it's like, you know, in my mind, the marginal business is the one that complains. The non-marginal business would have no problems because they would figure out something else to do. So,
I think that's right. I'm not. I don't have a dog in this fight in terms of Spotify versus Apple or Google versus Epic Games.
Although I don't have a dog in the fight.
It's more
either,
a question of as a consumer and as a producer. And frankly, if I put the regulator hat on for a second, how much should they be there? Yes. Does it keep out malware? Yes. I'm not suggesting there's no benefit to the current system. It's more a question of, given the current system, is it the most appropriate level of competition and charging fees, call it what you want, relative to a better solution?
I just answered that question for you, right? I don't have a dog in the fight. All I'm answering for you is that currently there's so much competition that Spotify can't survive because it has no ecosystem. Right. So,
but my point is that Apple and Google both charge 30%, right? At some point, if we had two banks who charge the same thing.
I think here is where you're mistaken, right? So let's take the issue with Spotify.
Yep.
Right? You subscribe to your music. You can take Android music. You can take Apple music. You can take Amazon music.
Sure.
Right? You could take Pandora.
Sure.
You can take XYZ.
Yep.
Right? When you're selling a commodity solution, you're not going to make much money on it. Right.
But I take your point. But I don't care about Spotify in particular. I think we need to argue the problems are often ecosystem, not just the Spotify.
No. But that's exactly where these are the complainants. Right. The complaints are coming from these people.
But let's assume they don't complain. The DOJ's question is still: given there are only two OS players with app stores, and given those two players are charging what in any other circumstance would be a extortionate proportion of revenue. So, you know, you couldn't if you're a retail landlord, if you're Westfield, you can't charge 30% of rent. If you're, you know, a vending machine player, you can't charge 30% of the
No. So here's where I think you're mistaken, right? Completely. So the retailer, unlike here, I guess, when you know the government has said that you don't have to pay rent, right? You have to realize that unlike a typical mall where everybody's paying a rent, mm-hmm. everybody's actually not paying a rent here, right? So when Google is running its Google Play Store, if you're free, Google gets zero.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So that, you know, like, I mean, it's a question of whether it's 15 or 30, but, you know, hey.
That is the question. That's my point.
I think regulators have no business trying to figure that out because they have no clue what to do. I mean, they would have never thought that you can actually have a free ecosystem of hundreds and thousands of apps which are free. Like, I mean, make your business something else other than transacting in digital currency and you're fine.
Okay, but if we had banks in Australia who said savings accounts are free, checks are free, but if you're on a home loan, you're going to have to pay me 30%. We would, and they said, you can use the free savings accounts, that's fine. But if you don't want to borrow to buy a home, don't borrow to buy a home, that's fine. It's not a problem. There's only two banks. You've got to pay 30% to both. I think we would all agree that was a system that would enhance or that government intervention would improve relative to. And that, I'm not saying they shouldn't be able to charge anything. Or no, that,
I think, again,
I'm not saying 30% is wrong. No, so I'm just saying, broadly speaking, the question is, you know, what a regulator / system overview should say, do these circumstances feel like they are an appropriate one for the market that we have and the market power that's being used, not abused necessarily, just used? You know, is that seem like a reasonable competitive solution in this marketplace?
No, so I think that's where, again, you're wrong. I'm going to say wrong pretty strongly because it's not, the analogy just doesn't work, right? It's not that the consumer is being hurt, right? The consumer still is able to get, you know, $5 music streaming.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the 30% or whatever it is being paid by the business.
Sure, but that gets reflected in prices. I mean,
but that has been. I think that the software distribution cost or the cost of applications is not exorbitant. It is, you know, there's plenty of competition. There's plenty of choice.
So how much are we too much? 50%, 90%?
I don't know. Like, but I think the current system just works. Like, I mean, you know, there is no problem with the current system. Sure, you want to tweak it 15%. Here's the thing. It does not make a bottom line difference whether it is 15% or 30% to either Apple or Google. It actually does not make any difference.
My point is only that the fact it could be either and the fact you're open to that is why it's worth the conversation.
Yeah, but it's not. Like, the regulators are the people who have no clue of how to deal with this. They would, as I said, they would have never figured out that you could actually have free services. Right. I don't give regulators that much credit. Maybe you do. But I think regulators are, you know, regulators do dumb things. They're basically known for doing dumb things. You know, again, in which world do you get 90% of your apps are free? 90% of the services that you get are free. What's the problem? You want to pay, you pay. Let's move on. It's like, you know, what is it? It's, as I said, the complainants here are basically all about, can I get more money in my pocket? It's not about the end consumer. And the complainants are always those businesses that are not innovative enough. I think that's where the problem is. Go innovate is what I say. Just go build a better business. Don't complain. I hate complainers.
We will see. We will see. We might leave it there, mate. I've got a quick question before we finish off and then we will end for today. Because while we're in the space of innovation, while we're in the space of banks, we talked about both of those today. A quick question we came through from Scott, not me, another Scott. He says, "Hi, Scott and Doc. Love the podcast. Long-time listener. Appreciate the education and entertainment you both provide." Well, hopefully we've done that today. "You both make your opinions on traditional banks quite clear." We've also done that today. But then Scott asks, "Do you have a view on the neobanks, such as Wiser, WIZR, I've got to say, mate, that was a new name for me, who appear to be increasing market share in," he says, "EO-like multiples," so extreme opportunities, your service, EO-like multiples. I'll restate this. "Do you have a view on neobanks, such as Wiser, who appear to be increasing market share quickly, have a focus on financial wellness, and don't have the same residential property exposure or bias? Love to hear your thoughts, Doc and Scott." So in this case, you know, the question is, we have given our views on banks. You're a little more negative than I am, but neither of us are buying banks anytime soon, for a whole lot of reasons, including their exposure to debt. Also, the question of, is there enough just sheer growth in the business itself? Even if you said, I don't think you'd believe this, I am a bit sanguine on it. Even if you said there's no crash coming, but where does the growth come from? In either of those scenarios, or you believe there's a crash, it's kind of like heads I lose a lot, tails I lose a little bit. It's not a great scenario. Do the neobanks, mate, interest you from an investment perspective, given they don't have those potential downsides, given they're disruptors who have, you know, all the market in front of them and no real legacy businesses or issues? Harder for the Commonwealth Bank to double in size, but easy for a neobank to grow tenfold and still not even appear on Commonwealth's radar, quite frankly. Small companies, as you invest in with extreme opportunities, are the place to make meaningful amounts of money if you can find the right ones and the ones that are going to go well. Have you looked at neobanks? Do you have a view? Have you kind of formed a sense of when and why you might invest in them?
So I haven't looked in much detail to know. So, I mean, yes, it's true. They're small. They can take some share from the big ones and they can grow. You know, banking as a whole, traditional banking is a difficult business, right? I mean, you know, you have to borrow money. So basically, it's a leveraged business where you're, you know, trying to make some money off a lot of leverage. So
it's, which is great when it works, and when it doesn't, it's painful, right?
So and you know, I don't know. I haven't looked at it, looked at any carefully to actually have a view. I like the fact that, you know, new banks are trying different things, which is good, but I don't have a view.
Yeah, I think Scott, I would avoid giving a view on them, in part because I think we tend to, a little bit like, you know, we talk about tech as if it's one thing, right? I think neobanks we talk about as one thing. Neobanks that I've seen, or at least those called neobanks, do everything from payday loans through to peer-to-peer lending, through to deposit services, through to everything else. And I think that's where you want to be a little bit careful, you know. To be fair, the banking sector, the non-neobanks, the traditional banks, are largely the same thing. They're big, they're old and slow, they tend to do, you know, deposit supported and money market supported funding of home loans and business loans, right? So they're kind of not exactly much of a muchness, but you can kind of throw a reasonably small blanket over all of them. When it comes to the neobanks, because they are new, because they are different, because they are small, because they, in some cases, are focused in very, very different areas, you want to be really careful of what you're buying, what they do. Now, again, I have no view on Wiser directly or others, what I would say is just be a little bit mindful that, you know, it's not just a small, nimble, new version of the existing banks, and so we can use the same frameworks. I just looked up Wiser, for example, and literally the Wikipedia description says it's a non-bank lender offering consumer lending services. It was called Direct Money. Originally, now it does what it does. Now, you know, borrowing $5,000 to $50,000. That to me doesn't sound like a neobank as much as it sounds like a non-bank lender that may or may not have, you know, a different funding cost. I haven't looked into it anywhere near deeply enough. What I would say though is, to some degree, if you're kind of just a white labeled re-lender, that's great. They knock yourself out. I wouldn't say that's a neobank in the same way as, for example, Square that Doc mentioned earlier in the chat, which is not exactly even offering the same service as a traditional bank, but it's getting a lot closer. I don't know, Doc, do you a question without notice on, say, Square? That to me sounds like a proper neobank as opposed to a new disruptive lender who wants to be called a neobank because it's kind of a cool term and I might get some nice halo effects from it.
Yeah, like Square is a much significantly bigger business. Like, you know, like Square probably is as big as one of the Australian banks now.
It's amazing.
But It's again, like, I mean, you have to start somewhere, right? Yeah, I mean, so I don't know, like, I mean,
I don't think it's bad in the moment. I'm just saying I wouldn't necessarily, I'm just careful of the label. I think when you start to say it's a neobank, it conjures up those ideas in people's heads of like, oh, I know what it is, I know what it does, I can buy shares in it because it's a neobank. All I would say is
neobanks
are all different to each other in a far greater way than, the big four banks are the same bank, really, honestly, right? They'll hate me saying that, but it's true. The neobanks are all really, really different from each other, or potentially really different from each other. You've got to be really careful what you're buying.
Yeah, and again, you know, are they, you know, just lending? Are they doing, you know, FPOS gathering? Are they linking customers to, you know, buyers and sellers? What is the type of banking they're doing? It's all important. Yeah.
What I will say, man, I have a really quick view on this. I see, to some degree, the neobanks as potentially being doing to banks what others have done to grocery. So if you think about, and this is a long analogy, but stick with me, not long, it's just different. Aldi, as a retailer, had a very specific way of saying, we're going to have a really small range, they're going to be really cheap, and we're going to focus on stuff we do really, really well. And they've carved out a really nice niche for themselves in Australia. Costco have been in the US for years, but have come to Australia and said, we do the opposite. We do, you know, really, really, really large purchases of really large quantities, you know, 144 rolls of toilet paper or, you know, 5 kilos of peanut butter. Very different, right? And I'll say, blessed with is probably too hard a term. The great thing about the Coles and Woolies supermarkets is you get everything there. They're all reasonably priced. You get everything in the one shop. It's kind of easy and simple. And they've done a great job of being everything to everybody, but not anything in particular really, really well. So they do everything reasonably well. Aldi have said, we're going to do a few things incredibly well. Costco have said, we're going to do a few different things incredibly well. And that starts to undermine Woolies and Coles themselves, right? Because you can't say, well, we're going to sell nappies and peanut butter and toilet paper and grog and, you know, baked goods and cold meats. And they'll give me reasonably priced. You'll come and get them all. They'll kind of cross-subsidize each other. We can, you know, baby food's always cheap because it drags people in. You'll pay a bit more for your, I don't know, baked beans or something else. That model of being something to everybody is a really convenient model for most people. But the new players have really disrupted that meaningfully, right? They've had to drop their prices, introduce private labels. It changed the whole dynamic of supermarkets. I think in banking, if I was a bank shareholder, that's what I'd be worried about is somebody looking around at the banking system and saying, hang on, they make X percent of their profits from these two things. I'm only going to do those two things. I don't have to cross-subsidize a branch network. I don't have to cross-subsidize deposit accounts, which they lose money on. And we don't like paying fees on deposit accounts, but let's be honest, they make no money on deposit accounts. It costs them money to provide. They're happy to make money on mortgages and credit cards. Now, if you've got another company that says, I'll do the credit cards, someone says, I'll do the loans, and the banks are stuck with deposit products and branches, you know, the model starts to break down really, really fast.
Yeah, but I mean, on the other hand, the deposit is also enabling them to provide those loans, right?
Totally.
I mean,
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, I mean, the deposit product is important from that point of view.
Yes.
You know, and it's actually even better if you can, you know, sucker someone up to deposit their money for 5 years, yes, right?
Right.
Guaranteed five years of fun.
Total deposit for, that's right.
Yeah,
for nothing.
So, again, like, it's probably too early. The other thing I'd caution is if a company is too small, especially a banking company that's too small, right? It could vanish and nobody would notice, kind of thing.
Yeah, be careful, hey?
Yeah, you should be careful, a little bit careful.
So if you're not looking for banks, but you are looking for great small cap stocks, you should join Doc's service, Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities. You can go to fool.com.au/EO podcast. I almost screwed that up, so let me go again. fool.com.au/EO podcast. I was thinking of what I was going to say next, which was, and you can join up to join Doc and Kevin. And Kevin's got his new father. So congratulations, Kevin. We should say that just for fun. I won't give away too many more details because Kevin may not want me to share them, but he's a new dad for the first time. So congratulations, mate, and to your lovely wife as well. Go to EO Podcast. Doc and Kevin do a fantastic job there of finding you, not the neobanks necessarily, although if there is a great neobank that's worthy of investment, they will definitely recommend it there. In the meantime, they are looking around the market, trying to find the ones that have better return potential, potentially less risk as well than those banks, a little more risk than the average bear, but hopefully a lot more return. That's certainly the success they've had so far. And as I'm saying, as I like to say, and as you already know, cheaper than a cup of coffee a week. What are you waiting for? Go to fool.com.au/EO podcast and join Doc. Now, we're going to have...
I was going to quickly say, it's not
please.
Cheap. Inexpensive.
I keep saying that.
I've been told by a member that we should not call it cheap.
No, it's not cheap. It's inexpensive.
It's not cheap. It's inexpensive.
Try it out. It's so bloody inexpensive. You honestly, I
it's hard to say that actually.
I can't say you can't lose because I guess you can always buy a bad pick or something and whatever. But man, if you've got a portfolio that's even four figures, and you can't justify a stupidly cheap, stupidly inexpensive price, let me be clear, to try Doc's service at EO, I don't know. I can't help you. All right. So go to fool.com.au/EO podcast. Yes, it's an ad, but it's also completely genuine. It drives me nuts that I can't get more people to come and join Doc or us at ShareAdvisor, but certainly Doc and Kevin at EO just to give it a go because just, you know, you spend more than that on a night out or a pair of jeans and they're not going to build your wealth, put it that way. All right. Before we go, mate, should we do a podcast mailbag on Sunday?
Is that secret anymore?
A special episode?
Special.
So if you do want to take part, hit us up on the socials. Let me go through them really, really quickly. info@fool.com.au for those who prefer email. You can hit us up on the Twitters. Doc is at Anirban Mahanti. And let me double up here. If you're on Twitter or Instagram, you can get me at TMF Scott P and The Motley Fool at The Motley Fool AU. And if you're on the book, the Facebook, the Book of Faces, go to The Motley Fool Australia or Scott Phillips Money. That's it, mate. We're done. We will be back Sunday. But before that, make sure you don't miss our Sunday mailbag episode by subscribing to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes, your favorite Android podcast app, or, of course, Podcast One. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a 5-star rating. Leave us a review. A quick note here, mate. We had a listener during the week send me someone. You know, I talk about tattooing on your body.
Uh-huh.
I saw the image come up, and I thought, oh god, tell me no one's put the Motley Fool on there. They haven't put the Motley Fool on their body. They've done something you would like much more.
Okay.
They literally tattooed S3XY and the Tesla symbol on the underside of their forearm.
They have done a very good job. What can
The Tesla models, Model S, Model 3, Model X, and Model Y, and a little Tesla symbol for the rest of their lives. So that is love. That is brand love, and I thought you'd appreciate that. In the meantime, don't do that. Well, do it if you want to, but I'm not going to suggest it. Instead of that, please give us a rating, leave us a review. Please tell your friends. If you're enjoying the podcast, we figure they will too. And of course, you can get a dose of foolishness and some marketing straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back on Sunday with a surprise. No, not surprise. A special mailbag edition. See you then. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.